Now, the forecast details from the National Weather Service. Today, sunny and mild, the high is 63. Tonight, clear and cold, the low of 38. By the way, sunset will be at 6:05. Friday, sunny, breezy, and mild with a high of 69. Weekend warms up. Saturday, sunny and 73. Sunday, sunny and 75. This morning, wind southwest at 5, 41 degrees in Racine, 40 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 minutes past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
We welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later in the hour, we're going to be hearing about this weekend's concert by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. But in part one of today's program, we're going to be talking about a musical that is about to open on the campus of the University of Wisconsin Parkside, Carrie the Musical. Carrie the Musical is based on the Stephen King novel, Carrie, and, of course, the award-winning film starring Sissy Spacek that was made about that novel. And, of course, a lot of people would say that adapting such a story for the musical stage is a bit of a stretch, but Carrie has quite a large audience of devoted fans, and something of a cult following, if you will. And actually, the history of the show, that history is actually quite interesting as well. And it's a show that I saw when the school I taught at, Carthage College, did it last year. And I am very, very excited at the opportunity to see it once again, this time at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. The director of that production is Mary McDonald Kerr, who is a visiting assistant professor of theater arts. And so in the midst of a very busy week of final rehearsals, we have a few minutes to talk with her about Parkside's production of Carrie the Musical, opening this weekend and running for the next two weekends. Mary McDonald Kerr, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Since this is our first conversation on the morning show, maybe you could give our listeners just a brief sketch of who you are and where you come from and the kind of things that have been the most important part of your professional life in the theater.
Okay. I have been a theater artist in the Milwaukee area for 28 seasons. I do a lot of acting and directing at the theaters in Milwaukee, like Next Act and Renaissance Theater and Milwaukee Chamber Theater. And I started about 6 or 7 years ago directing at universities. I directed Urinetown at Carthage and Mother Courage at Carthage. And I work professionally often with Brian Gill, who was a professor here at Parkside. And an opening came open for me to come work here for a bit, and I jumped at the chance. I live in Paddock Lake, so it's nice and close, and so I'm having a great time.
Wonderful.
I just started in September.
Very good. So, and I saw both of those productions that you mentioned at Carthage, so it turns out that I have seen your fine work, and I'm excited now that we can spend a few minutes talking about Carrie the Musical. I'm guessing, since you are a visiting professor, that perhaps you didn't have a whole lot to do with the decision for the Parkside Theater Department to present Carrie the Musical. But am I wrong about that, or is this
No, I
just
had nothing to do with the decision. I came in after they decided last spring, and that was before the faculty changes that came about were even thought of yet. And so I inherited it, but I was happy to, because I don't generally get a chance professionally to direct musicals, but I love doing it. And so I was intrigued. I happened to be old enough to have seen Carrie the movie when it came out. I was 15, I think. And I've often been intrigued by the story and the fact that, you know, anyone ever thought to make it a musical. So it's been really fun.
Hmm. So there is the possibility that somebody is listening to this interview that has little or no acquaintance with the original story by Stephen mm-hmm. King. So for the sake of anybody or maybe somebody who needs a little bit of a reminder or refresher, explain the most basic framework of the story of Carrie, and then we'll dig into what it's like as a musical.
Okay, great. So, you know, the original source material is a Stephen King novel. It's a classic gothic horror story in the Stephen King's tradition. It's about a teenage girl who is relentlessly bullied by her high school compatriots, and she ends up discovering that she has some telekinetic powers that are being born as she adolesces, and the combination of the rage from being bullied and these supernatural powers meet, and she ends up getting some pretty big revenge on those who bully her. I don't want to totally give away the whole story. But she has a very strict fundamentalist mom who also adds to the mix of her really not having a place in the world and declaring a place in the world. You know, it's a great story to be telling here in Halloween time, but it's also really, it's been interesting to work on the piece because when it came out in 1976, the notion of a teenager being bullied, getting this kind of size of revenge on her classmates was kind of mind-blowing, right? That wasn't something that was happening, and it was so interesting and gothic. But now through the years and through the lens of this happening quite often in real life, it's there's a whole different level of the story that wasn't there when it was originally written.
Hmm. Tell us what you know about the long odyssey, if you will, of original story to its adaption to the stage as a musical.
Well, what I know is that I believe, so in 1988, I believe was the first time they tried to make it into a musical, which is only 12 years after the movie. And it had, there was a lot of money put into it. There was some star power. Betty Buckley played the Margaret, the mom, and I can't come up with her name right now, but a very famous woman played Carrie. But it was a notorious flop. It closed, I think, before it opened. You know, I think it was in previews, and there were people getting hurt, and there was this legend of it being kind of cursed. But then in 2012, I believe, it was rewritten. The whole thing was rewritten, book, music, and everything, and opened and had good positive reviews and had a decent run on Broadway. And then since then, it's very popular with colleges because 90% of the cast plays someone around their age, which is hard to find. And it's also the source material is very appealing to this age group. So it gets done often. It's a beast of a play because, you know, musicals have a lot of stuff generally, but this one has, you know, special effects in it that are tricky to figure out how to do. And the music itself is very demanding. So to be able to find the singers who can pull it off is tricky. We have amazing singers in ours. It's really, I think that's why the person who picked it, who was very intimately familiar with the talent pool here at Parkside, you know, did a great job because the singing is fantastic. But yeah, so it's had kind of a long, but it really does have a cult following. And there have been television shows that reference the you know, original Carrie the Musical flop. And there have been musicals written about the musical that flopped. You know, it's just like the gift that keeps on giving, the story of it becoming a musical.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today in part one of today's morning show with Mary McDonald Kerr. She is a visiting assistant professor of theater arts at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And she is the director of their production of Carrie the Musical, which is opening at Parkside this weekend and running the next two weekends. And I think I'm pretty safe to assume that this is not being done in Parkside's studio theater in that intimate setting.
No.
I'm sure this is on the ComArts stage. Yes.
Yeah.
So talk for a moment about, I guess I'm curious to know kind of about the dimensions of this production. I mean, kind of the essential dimensions of the play, the sort of the scope of the story and what it takes to bring that story alive on the stage visually.
Well, it's interesting. It's one of those plays that changes location really frequently. So you kind of have to decide whether you want to have constant set changes, which can be very bulky and burdensome. And so we have kind of a stylized take on that. We have some panels and some things that are wheeled, and they end up shifting around with the cast, shifts them around in the transitions between scenes. We have projections that are projected onto the panels that are very effective. We have some real furniture pieces, but it's not hyper realistic the way that it's the scenery, or we would be here for 4 hours because it just changes location. And then there are tricky things, like there's a scene in the locker room, and then there's a scene, you know, in someone's dining room, and then there's a big prom that you have to throw. And then there are some things that I don't want to talk about that have to happen. So there's a lot to it. So I think that when it comes to literal scenery, less is more with it. And so I think that's also has ended up being its own design element, watching the panels shift around and become and morph into different things. And we have a great choreographer working on the piece who's helped a lot with that kind of thing. And I think it's visually really great.
Hmm. So you mean the choreographer has had a hand in some of these transitional moments? Is that what you're saying?
A little bit of a hand when we bumped up. I staged most of them, but occasionally when it's been, we needed something that looked particularly dancey, he added it, because we don't want it to look like the set, you know, people are moving furniture. So there's kind of a movement element to the way the panels are moving around stage. And plus there was a lot of choreography he had to do in the numbers. You know, there are big dance numbers within the musical as well.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that I was struck by when I first saw this show was, obviously, in some ways, it's quite an unconventional choice of story, and yet there are a lot of ways in which this is a fairly conventional musical, and I mean that in the best sense of the word. I mean, people should not be expecting an evening of just kind of utter weirdness. This looks like and feels like a musical, but the fact that it is the story of Carrie is part of what really makes it an extraordinary experience.
Yes, I agree.
Tell us a bit about this title character. We've already touched on the essential story, but tell us more about the character of Carrie, the central character of Carrie, and how you see her and what it has been like to work with the student who is portraying her in this production.
Well, I see her as a survivor of abuse on many levels. I think that she has an abusive parent, and then she has, from growing up in that household, she is socially awkward and terrified, and because of that behavior, she ends up getting bullied at school. She's a natural scapegoat for that outlet of that kind of stuff that happens during that time of her life. In the novel, she has her powers from a very young age, and those powers kind of scare the crap out of her mother, who then treats her a certain way because thinks that she's, you know, a witch. So that's where a lot of the oppression comes from the mom. So she's a powder keg waiting to happen. And Stephen King explores Carrie is also in the middle of adolescing, and Stephen King explores that kind of that feminist dark side, the fear of women coming into their power as they become sexual beings, and that's very strong. There's a lot of feminine rage, you know, that novel. There's been a lot of writings about that, evaluating the gothic and feminist issues in the novel. And so, you know, this play is really about women. It's Carrie and it's Carrie's mom. And then there's the two girls at school, one who's the big bully and one who is a bully who sees the error of her ways and tries to make it up to Carrie. The male characters are definitely secondary, and that's very unusual in a lot of big Broadway musicals, that it's all, you know, there are boyfriends in the story, but all of the plot is centered around how the women are treating each other, how the females are treating each other.
Mm. How are you handling the matter of Carrie's, let's say, personality? And the way in which the student portraying her is convincing in terms of making Carrie seem, I should think we need to think of her as a human being with whom we feel some sympathy, and of course there also needs to be something, in a sense, almost otherworldly about her as well.
Yes, she is socially awkward. She has a lot of anxiety. She has PTSD from being, you know, she lives her day in fight or flight mode because she never knows when someone's going to knock into her, push her down, or you know, call her a horrible name. And those kinds of things, I think, are normal, right? And the actress who plays with her has done a great job of getting in touch with what that would be like. You know, it was important to me that she's not a Disney princess. She's not a classic, you know, heroine or ingenue. And it's not that, like, oh, if she just put on a pretty dress and got invited to prom, everything would be okay. That there's something that's different about her, and some of it is hereditary, and some of it was caused by the way she's been treated all of her life. And I do think that the supernatural part of it is that, for whatever reasons, her rage, her reaction to this is unleashing a power that I'm not so sure isn't in everyone in this world. It's just that Carrie's experiences have concentrated her reaction to the bullying so crystallized that it unleashes this power. King writes very human supernatural beings, right? He's pretty brilliant at that. That they're not monsters or angels, but they're humans that somehow are in touch with parts of the world that we don't see, that maybe if we looked, we would see them.
Hmm. Of course, this story is populated with a number of characters that are not exactly on the side of good.
No.
And I'm tempted to call them villains, and there's probably at least a couple of characters that maybe fully deserve that, but you know, it's also, you know, people who are young people who are confused, and maybe typical mm-hmm. teenagers or whatever. How have you thought about those characters and how to, in a sense, present them to the audience? And to any extent, should we be feeling sympathy and empathy for them, or is it okay for them to really feel like the bad guys, to put it kind of bluntly,
right.
And frankly.
Well, one of the challenges of the musical is that the way it was written, it does ask you to have some empathy compared to the novel. So they're much more, this version of it does give chances to the mom for the audience to feel for her in the midst of all this abuse. And that has been challenging as an actor for us to find. You have to go to the place that's really bad and then have that kind of shame shower of the abuser afterwards and understand her faith is so strong. For however she got there, she always thinks she's doing the right thing, even though on the outside it looks horrible, but it's all based in her version of the Bible. And so she does have some second thoughts, but in the end, you know, she does what she thinks is right, which no one in the audience would agree with. And then the kids, I think, are all swept up. You know, the ringleader has been really spoiled by her family, and she doesn't have good role modeling. She has a song about how her dad taught her to be top dog, and that includes not having empathy for anyone. And I think it's a really good, relevant song for where we are right now in this country. But she causes a lot of trouble, but I see how she got that way. I don't think anybody's born. I personally don't think people are born evil. So I think you do see how the villains, quote unquote, got to be villains.
Mm. I think that
in the original Gothic story, Stephen King does like good and evil, the forces of good and evil, and doesn't justify how someone became that way. And that's, you know, that's the tradition of fairy tale and fable and Gothic tales. So it's interesting. We're in an age where, you know, there's movies about how the Joker became the Joker or how the Wicked Witch became the Wicked Witch, where we seem to be really interested in finding out how the villains became villains. And it's an interesting trend in storytelling.
Absolutely, and probably overdue in some respects. It's it's fertile ground for exploration, and it's interesting that it's taken this long for some of these questions to be posed. We are recording this interview on Wednesday morning before you open. How are things feeling with this big, complicated production of this challenging show?
I think we're going to make it. It's Friday we open, and we have a lot of work to do between now and then, but we have the time, and so I think it's in really good shape. I think the kids are remarkable. It's just about filling out the technical stuff that's challenging. And, you know, they have to do this play where normally it would be a full-time job to do something like this, but they're all still going to class and doing their homework, and you know, so it's a lot. It's a lot to get done in the amount of time that we have. But we're going to make it, and it's going to be great.
Right. Well, we wish everybody on stage and off stage associated with Carrie a great, great success as performances occur this coming weekend and the next weekend on the main stage at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Do you happen to have handy information on what people should do if they want to secure tickets?
I can only tell you to Google, look up the box office at the Rita Talent Center on the Parkside campus.
Simple matter. Yep. And and the Parkside website, which is of course uwp.edu, is very, very easy to navigate. And right there on the front page is a link to events related to the arts. And there you will find even more information about when and where and how to see Carrie the musical. And the director of the production, Mary McDonald Kerr. Mary McDonald Kerr, thank you so much for making time for this conversation in what I know is a busy week. And best wishes to you and all of your cast and crew.
Thank you so, so much.
Thank you. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. And this portion of WGTD's morning show is being spent with two gentlemen who have been on the morning show any number of times before, both intimately involved in the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. We're talking to its conductor, Robert Hasty, and also to the president of the board, Pete Rodriguez, who also is a member of the French horn section. And we're going to be talking about the season opener of the Kenosha Symphony, a concert Saturday evening, October 19th, 7:30 p.m., a concert called Slavic Sentiments, which will feature a wonderful overture by the early Russian composer Mikhail Glinka, and then the fourth symphony by the great Peter Tchaikovsky. So we'll be talking about both of those works in just a moment. First, we welcome Robert Hasty and Pete Rodriguez. Welcome back to both of you to the morning show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Greg. Maestro, we are recording this interview actually on Friday, the 11th of October. And we feel fortunate to have connected with you because on this day, Florida is picking up the pieces after Hurricane Milton. And you are speaking to us from your home in Winter Springs, Florida, near Orlando. We don't have a whole lot of time, but maybe you could just speak briefly to what you and others have been through over the last few days in terms of preparing for and then enduring the onslaught of Hurricane Milton.
Well, as a new Floridian, I'm learning a lot. I remember early in my teaching career, I used to live in Southern California, and we had to do things like, you can't prepare for earthquakes. I would be teaching students, and then suddenly there was an earthquake, and what do you do? I remember in living in Illinois, we had to prepare for a polar vortex, and sometimes we would have storm windows, for those kind of weather systems. So moving down to Florida, it's a totally new experience, and everybody is extremely cautious down here. So I teach at the University of Central Florida. I'm director of orchestral activities, and I saw, for days, everybody knows that this weather is coming, and they closed down the schools. UCF, I had a rehearsal on Monday night, and then we haven't been on campus since, but that was planned that way so that students can go home. Schools have been closed around here. I've learned a lot from my neighbors what to do. We have way too much water, right? I mean, drinking water. and way too much water in the other category as well. But it's all about preparing and, keeping some ice on hand. Mostly for those of us in the Orlando area, we were simply planning on a lot of power outages, and we really didn't get that many. And I take a little responsibility because my first concert down here was scheduled on September 26th. And then we had another hurricane cancellation for Helene. And then I had a concert scheduled for Wednesday night. And Wednesday night, just 2 days ago, and then we had Milton. So I think I probably have something to do with the fact I need to be careful when I schedule concerts.
I guess so. Well, hopefully you're not bringing that bad luck to Kenosha with this concert coming up on October 19th. And we're glad that where you are in Florida, at least, did not endure some of the really devastating effects of Milton that hit other parts of Florida, of course, very, very hard. We're glad that you're okay.
My thoughts are with those people who had to evacuate and got hit very hard in the Tampa area and Sarasota. I know we have one member of the Kenosha Symphony who also plays in the Sarasota Orchestra down here, and I think she has property. So I'm very curious to hear how things went with Lorraine, our cellist.
Right. Well, we're glad that we could connect today and talk about this concert featuring the Kenosha Symphony that will be Saturday evening. Again, a concert that's going to be called Slavic Sentiments. Before we get to this concert, Pete Rodriguez, president of the board, maybe you could briefly outline for us the dimensions of this upcoming season, of which this concert on the 19th is just the first.
Sure, yes. We're very excited about this first concert starting our season. And as you mentioned, it's focused on Slavic composers. The next one will be in December 7th, to be precise. It's our holiday concert. It's graciously sponsored by Snap-on Incorporated, but we are again collaborating with the Kenosha Academy of the Performing Arts, as well as the Kenosha Chamber Choir, which we're thankful for because, of course, during COVID times, we weren't able to incorporate them into our holiday concert. So it's great that we'll be doing that again. And then in the spring, May 10th, we will be featuring a cellist, Alex Hirsch, and he's going to be performing the Haydn Cello Concerto and will also be featuring music by Italian composers, including Rossini and actually he's the Italian composer. And then there's Mendelssohn's Symphony No. 4, which is labeled the Italian, but that's also on the concert.
One of my favorites. In fact, years ago when for a while the morning show had a commercial running on cable television, that was the music that played in the background, was the opening theme of the Mendelssohn Fourth Symphony. So that work has a very special place in my heart, and happy to hear that we'll have the opportunity to hear it played live by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. Maestro Hasty, let's talk about Slavic sentiments and what was behind your decision in terms of the repertoire that will be featured on Saturday evening's concert.
Well, I'm grateful, as always, to President Pete and the board, who give me the parameters. And occasionally, regularly, they will say, "This concert, you can have the full forces of symphonic power." And so when I get that, that means I can have lots of percussion and lots of brass and and lots of fireworks. And so with this one, of course, I realized that we had not done the Fourth Symphony by Tchaikovsky during my tenure. I think the only Tchaikovsky symphony the Kenosha Symphony has done in the past 12 years has been the Fifth Symphony. But this one is extremely powerful. So I first scheduled that, and then I realize, well, let's make this, as you said, the title is Slavic, but this is 19th century Russia at the time. And so we have Tchaikovsky, and then we have his mentor, Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, also on the program. And then we go back even further, the teacher and the influencer of Rimsky-Korsakov, Mikhail Glinka. So when you look at this program in general, we start with the father of Russian music, Mikhail Glinka, who, by the way, lived in Spain and accumulated and collected a lot of Russian folk music while he was there. And then when he became Rimsky-Korsakov's teacher, he kind of exposed the composer to a lot of these themes and a lot of these tunes. And it was because of that Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov wrote the music that you're going to hear on this program, which is Capriccio Espanol. Capriccio Espanol was, Tchaikovsky himself was a big fan of this particular piece, and he called it a complete masterwork, and it was very influenced by this piece. And then just a few years later, Tchaikovsky wrote the Fourth Symphony, which has a lot of wonderful themes and important moods that are in that. Mm. So we could talk about each one individually, but I think I'll just start with Tchaikovsky if you like.
Sure, sure.
Okay, so with Tchaikovsky, like I said, this was in a very challenging part of his life. It was written between 1877 and 1878, and it was dedicated to his patron, which is Madame von Meck, or Nadeshka von Meck. These are the things that Tchaikovsky was going through when he wrote this piece. He had been married for a little bit longer than President Pete has been married so far. President Pete was married just last month, but Tchaikovsky was married for 2 months, and that's as long as it lasted. So we all hope that our President Pete, that I have a feeling that's going to go much longer than 2 months. He was also going through writer's block at the time, and he was struggling with his sexuality when he wrote this piece, and severe depression. So you can hear the urgency and the violence. And when I say violence, that's with a C in at the end, not with an S like our violin section. And so you can hear these moods throughout this piece. So the opening bar starts with something very similar to what Beethoven did, which is talking about fate. And so very, very fateful. He called it the fateful power which prevents one from attaining the goal of happiness. So when you think about that mood, that's the music that you hear. But here's the thing, Tchaikovsky, we all know, is just a melodic master because he wrote this beautiful tune in the second movement, starting with the oboe, that's very optimistic. And it's called Andantino in modo di canzone. So it's all about singing. It's all about a lovely song. And then in this third movement, it's one of the most cheerful things you've ever heard. He has the violin, he has the whole string section take their bows and put them in their laps or on their stands, and they're just playing pizzicato all the way throughout. And then he brings in just the woodwinds and the brass in unusual combinations, and it looks like he's just kind of improvising and just having a lot of fun with that. And in the finale, it's like a Russian folk celebration. He was in Italy when he was thinking about this, and he was very homesick. So he was writing some traditional Russian folk songs, and to quote him, he said, "Take joy in others' joy." So if he was not feeling joy himself, he was looking at the joy that others were experiencing. But then, of course, fate returns, and to quote Tchaikovsky, fate again appears and reminds you of yourself. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the most emotionally powerful pieces that in all of music, and I think it's one of the reasons why Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony is one of his favorites.
Well, and it says a lot about, as you said, you set the context beautifully in terms of all that he was going through, and if I remember correctly, his trauma and unhappiness essentially prompted him even to attempt to end his own life. I mean, this was someone who was completely falling apart, and yet somehow there is, in the end, a spirit of some optimism that somehow Tchaikovsky is going to climb out of this, and it's sort of a message of hope wrapped up in this beautiful symphony.
It's a message of hope. It's kind of like an aural experience of the anxiety that all of us still go through in our life. And I think another contrast is the piece before. So that's the center of the concert. But the first half of the concert is the overture by Glinka, and then Rimsky-Korsakov, Capriccio Espanol. And when you just hear the word Capriccio, very joyful, very playful. And when Rimsky-Korsakov wrote this piece in 1887, he, like I said, was influenced by Glinka's travels to Spain. And he originally wrote it for violin and orchestra, but then he expanded it. So you have, he's featuring all the different soloists in the orchestra, and he wrote it for, I believe, for his students in St. Petersburg. So it's very similar to a symphony concertante or a concerto grosso in the fact that it's not just the orchestral sound, but individual soloists. So it starts with this albarada, this Spanish dance, and it features our two members of our orchestra, Orlando Pimentel on clarinet, and David Cao, who is a candidate for associate concertmaster with the Kenosha Symphony, and also a former student of mine at Northwestern University when he was studying music. And so this is a great opportunity to show off the talents of the Kenosha Symphony individuals. So when you get to hear this, you realize how talented the members of our orchestra are. And then sometimes it's by section. So the four horn players, they play this beautiful melody in the third movement. The second movement, the variations, where they start off with this beautiful chorale. It's just one of those, it's really a fantasy and just designed to showcase all of these different beautiful instruments. And Tchaikovsky's the one, I'm gonna quote Tchaikovsky when he heard it. He called it a colossal masterpiece of instrumentation. So once again, and Rimsky-Korsakov being one of the five, what they called the five, which was the Russian nationalists at the time, he, of that group of five, was the only professional musician, the one who was part of the conservatory at the time. So the audience, if you haven't heard this piece and how joyous it is and how it all comes back together with this fandango, he has all the string players. It says a la guitarra, which means I've seen some orchestras where the violins and violas actually put their instruments in their lap and imitate a guitar. Mm. And then I've also seen some where they keep it on the shoulder, but they put their bow down and then they strum we'll decide that in rehearsals. Mm. And then of course, Glinka, Mikhail Glinka, the father, the first Russian music genius and the founder of the National School of Composition, he wrote two operas, and the way that he wrote opera, he was very influenced by the bel canto tradition. So he was looking at Italian composers such as Donizetti and Bellini for influence for these operas, and he actually moved to Spain for a while, which is where he got transferred the interest in Spanish music to Rimsky-Korsakov. But in 1842, he wrote a second opera called Ruslan and Ludmilla. And he wrote this amazing overture that anybody who played high school music and played in honor orchestras or youth symphonies, you've probably played it. Mm-hmm. It's definitely on the top 10 greatest hit lists of youth orchestras and community orchestras. And it's one of those pieces that if you've been in music through college, you've probably played this at least once. Mm. And it's a great way to start the night on Saturday.
It's one of my very, very favorite pieces. Pete Rodriguez, I was going to ask you what your favorite thing is to play on this concert, but I realize we're having this conversation before there's been a single rehearsal. But I assume you've had a chance to at least peek at the scores, peeking at the music that you'll be playing. I'm just curious, is that moment from Capriccio Espanol what you're most eagerly looking forward to, or are there other treasures for the French horn that are part of this evening's repertoire?
Yeah, there's a lot to love here, and one thing, you know, it's easy to not pay attention as much to the Glinka as a brass player, because you know, we're kind of just like the spices. We just have a lot of upbeats and just some quarter notes and half notes while we get to watch all the strings, you know, have their bow flying. Their bows are flying while they're doing all that fun stuff in there. So I'm sure they have their own challenges in that piece. But to answer your question, yes, that second movement that Bob mentioned is definitely a highlight for the horn section. In fact, the first horn player has a well-known solo that's often on audition lists. So that's something I'm looking forward to hearing. But the Tchaikovsky has its own challenges. I'm playing third horn, and that's one of the higher horn parts. And so just making sure I leave some gas in the tank, so to speak, to make it to the end of the concert. But yeah, there's so many great movements, especially the horns in the first movement. We get to start that symphony. So, I mean, of course, I'm very excited about that.
Absolutely, understandably. So, Maestro Hasty, just give us some sense of the timetable once you have returned to the Midwest. How many rehearsals are we talking about in order to put together Saturday evening's concert?
Well, when we do standards like this, we have such wonderful professional musicians who have probably played each of these pieces numerous times. So it's going to be like review. So on Thursday night, we will start rehearsals and we have the concert on Saturday night. So with a dress rehearsal on Saturday morning. So it's very quick, which is the traditional professional rehearsal schedule where we're literally starting just 2 days before. But because of the professional expectation of the musicians, they arrive prepared, and I'm just here to fine tune and to mold it into my informed interpretation, which I've kind of talked with you about. And I'm also very careful of the stamina. A lot of this, because we have to understand that what Pete was talking about the stamina that is required. These composers, being so professional and being so well trained in composition, they almost built in those breaks for brass players, and they get to just sit and listen in that third movement for a very, very long time. And it's almost like they get to just, okay, they get to have this moment of repose before all of the power comes back in the last movement. Same thing with Rimsky-Korsakov, because he not only was a composer, but he was a teacher. So he was influencing young composers like Tchaikovsky on how to compose and how to use instrumentation to the best possible effect musically, but also for the musicians, because he was working with those student musicians, as both you and I do, Greg. And so we have to really understand that it's not just about the music, but it's about the instrumentation, and it's about the human beings that are playing those instruments. So those are the things that I think about when I prepare for rehearsals.
Very good. And fortunately, we're talking about three very expert and skilled composers, and three examples of the very best of what they gave the world. So music of Tchaikovsky, Rimsky-Korsakov, and Glinka on the program for Saturday evening's concert at 7:30 p.m. Pete Rodriguez, tell listeners what they need to do if they are interested in attending Saturday night's concert.
Sure. If they go to KenoshaSymphony.org, they can purchase tickets online, and that will direct them to a link on Eventbrite, which is the company that manages our ticket sales. That can be done, of course, before the concert, but someone could also come to the concert and pay at the box. Tickets are $30 for adults. Students and children are free, so that's definitely a nice perk of the Kenosha Symphony to bring your children to this concert. But that's how you can get tickets, and we hope to see as many of you there.
Very good. Pete Rodriguez will be playing French horn Saturday night, and he is president of the board of the Kenosha Symphony, and on the podium, the artistic director of the Kenosha Symphony, Maestro Robert Hasty. My thanks to both of you for joining me today on the morning show, and best wishes for a very successful concert on Saturday night.
Thank you, Greg. Good to see you.
Thank you, Greg.
The Larry Mueller Show now airs weekdays from 11 to 1 on WGTD. Join me, Larry Mueller, as we tackle topics designed to make your living better.
That's Larry Mueller from 11 to 1 with a 6-minute break for the WGTD News at Noon with Dave McGrath and Bob Hagerty.
This is the weekly test of the emergency alert system on WGTD. 91.1 FM, Kenosha, Racine, news and classical music on your gateway to public radio. This is only a test. this concludes the weekly test of the emergency alert system on WGTD 91.1 FM, Kenosha, Racine, your gateway to public radio. It is 9 o'clock. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR, and Wisconsin Public Radio.